You're listening to a special edition of the Squamish Chief's Squamish Sound Podcast. In this interview, you're going to hear from Clayton Matthews. He is a local Squamish climber who just summited Everest. He talks about unprecedented crowding at the top of the world and how he trained in Squamish and more in this full-length interview. Take a listen.
How long have you been thinking about going to Mount Everest?
I started really mountaineering and climbing in 2011. As I progressed through taller and taller mountains, I kind of thought it would be a possibility. So probably since about 2014. So I actually was planning to go in 2020. And I have two friends that I actually climbed Denali with, and they were wanting to go this year. So I decided to join them. They asked me, and then went ahead with it. And then at the last couple of months before we were ready to leave, the other two partners actually dropped out, so I ended up going by myself.
Wow, you decided to carry on instead.
Yeah, I was already committed. I had given my deposit, and I wasn't going back, and I had been training for 4 months already, and I was feeling good, and I just decided to keep going.
So let's talk about some of that training. What do you do to get ready?
So my training program is one that I bought from Steve House. He's a pretty well-known alpinist. He has his own company. It's called Uphill Athlete. He has a book to go along with it. So I purchased a six-month expedition training program through them and followed it, and then some. I actually followed their training program, but I also climbed on top of it. So I had a pretty high level of fitness going into Everest.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that living in Squamish gave you an advantage for that?
Oh, absolutely. Laps up and down the Chief, carrying a 60-pound pack, that was invaluable. Even though it wasn't at altitude, it was at sea level, but just carrying lots of weight, lots of mileage, you know, steep hills, that helped out a lot.
A lot of talk is going on about how there are more inexperienced climbers on Everest than ever before. How important do you think it is to do that training and to have that experience before heading up?
Oh, it's critical. There's people that are definitely inexperienced, and they get to the cracks, and they actually can get up fairly high with a bit of help, you know, and that's where the problems lie, because they tend to cause traffic and lineups when there's busy days. So then that's what you see in the news right now. The 23rd and 24th were pretty busy because a lot of the bigger Western companies all decided to wait. They didn't go for the first windows where we did. So then you had the traffic and then inexperienced climbers on top of that, and you end up with huge lineups.
Tell me about, when did you summit? When did you go for that push?
The company that I went with, they follow Climbing the Seven Summits fairly closely. There's a bit of a relationship there. That group was committed to the second window. Their motto is, we always have good weather after the 20th. So they were never really looking at those first few days. There's a windstorm around the beginning of May. And it took out a lot of tents. Like, it took out a lot of tents on the north side. It took out a lot of tents on the south side. We actually just missed that storm, and we actually had our camp prepared, so we didn't really lose anything during that storm. But a lot of the groups that were trying to acclimatize didn't get above Camp 2 or Camp 3, so their rotations were cut short. So there was quite a few teams that actually weren't ready to climb on that first window. But we had just made it, so we were acclimatized. We were ready to go, and I worked really hard to convince our expedition leader and the management back in Kathmandu to let us at least go up to Camp 2. Even though the fixed lines weren't in yet and the route wasn't open yet, just let's go up to Camp 2 and put ourselves in position, and if the fixed lines are in, we'll keep going. And so that's pretty much what we did. We moved from base camp up before the route was even open, which our team management didn't really want to do. They weren't really comfortable with that. So we got good news that the route was getting put in. The route was coming along, and so we kept moving up. And then when we got to Camp 3, the rope fixing team actually summited that day. That was on the 14th. They came down. We actually met them in Camp 3 and talked to them for a bit and got route data from them. And we kept going up after that, and we summited on the 16th.
So that was before, I guess we can call them, traffic jams that we've been seeing in some pretty viral photos.
Yeah, so those photos were taken most of them were taken on the 23rd and the 24th, which was like the second big window. I think some people got up on the 21st. It was a small group, but it was windy, and a bunch of them got frostbite, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
But the second window, the 23rd and 24th, there was, man, there had to be at least 8 big teams climbing on those days.
When you were summiting, what was it like in terms of crowds or business? Can you describe those moments?
I was really fortunate. Even in our acclimatization climbs, like all of our climbs to Camp 1, to Camp 2, back down to base camp, and then back up to Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, and then back down to base camp. Through all those climbs, I actually didn't really run into very much traffic at all. And I had my camera with me, so I was trying to stay away from people to get pictures and stuff like that. So I did pretty good staying away from crowds. I was actually really fortunate. On our summit push, we got up at about 8 o'clock at night to leave at 9. When I slipped out of the tent at about 9, I was the first one out of our group to leave camp. I looked up the mountain, and there was at least 40 people or more ahead of us already. People had already left at like 7 and 8 o'clock, so there was quite a few people that had a pretty good head start on us. Most of the climbers were climbing on the left side of the fixed line, because most people are right-handed, so they're climbing on the left side. So when I got to the first few slower groups, I ended up just pulling out my ice axe and climbing on the right side of the rope, unclipped, and just grabbing a hold of the fixed line whenever I needed a bit of a break with my left hand. And so when the groups would stop, I would pass a bunch of people and then grab back onto the rope. And then when I get to the next group and they would stop for a rest, I would pass them. So I ended up getting ahead of that whole group of, you know, 30 or 40 people. And so I had a huge empty space in front of me before there was the first summiters. The first summiters were on a different oxygen system. They had like a really high flow oxygen system, and they had Sherpas going along placing bottles for them. Mm-hmm. So they were moving. They were flying. There was no catching those guys. So those guys summited in the dark, actually, at about 5 o'clock in the morning. I summited probably within the first, you know, 10 to 15 people. That viral photo that you see of the huge lineup near the summit on the Cornish Traverse, there was nobody along there for me. There was nobody on the Hillary Step. When I got to the summit, there was only like 6 people. We probably spent an hour there because my Sherpa had a bunch of flags and everything for his company and a bunch of stuff for his family that he wanted pictures with. And then I had a bunch of stuff as well. So by the time you take everything out and put it back in and take photos, you know, like we chewed up probably half an hour each, and then we left the summit. And then this has, by the time we left the summit, there was a good 20 people up there for sure. I don't know if you've seen the picture and the video of the guy with the saxophone, but he got up there just as, yeah, he started playing just as I was leaving. So it was kind of surreal walking off the summit of Everest with somebody playing a saxophone in the background. It was pretty neat.
Where were you when those crowds did ascend on May 23rd and 24th? How did you find out what that scene was like?
I was actually already back down to Namche. So 16th was the end of the window. The window was only really the later day of the 14th, which is when the rope team summited. The 15th was a good day, and then into the 16th. So by the time we got back down to Camp 4 at the South Col, the wind started to pick up. And so we were actually forced to stay in Camp 4 the night of the 16th. We couldn't go down because of the wind. So we stayed in Camp 4 on the 16th, and then the morning of the 17th, we got up early and descended. And I went with the Sherpa and descended all the way to base camp. The rest of my team stayed in Camp 2. Actually, they stayed in Camp 2 for 2 days to rest.
Why did you decide to go all the way back down?
I just wanted to get off the mountain and get down, mm-hmm. just to get out of the altitude. And I was actually feeling pretty good, so I got to Camp 2, and I could have stayed, but the Sherpa, there was 3 Sherpa that were leaving, and so I just joined with them and went back down to base camp. And the food's better, you know. Mm-hmm. I actually had a cot, so I actually pretty much had a bed down there, so, you know, it's just better rest and better place to sleep and better food.
And so was it at base camp where you heard about these crowds?
No, so I got the base camp on the 17th, spent the 18th there, packed, and on the 19th, I hiked directly from base camp to Namche, which is like about 30 kilometers. And then I spent 3 days in Namche waiting for the rest of my group to come down. Namche's beautiful. There's bakeries. The food there is really good. It's 2,000 meters lower. So as soon as I got to Namche, I started feeling great. I waited for the rest of my team there. That's when that second summit push was starting, was when I was in Namche. So I was pretty much reading the news as everybody else was, as it was coming online and on Facebook and social media.
And what did you make of it? What did you think when you saw what it was really like?
I was really, really thankful that we climbed on the days that we did, for sure. They were kind of horrifying photos.
So there's also been a lot of media attention, not only on the crowds and how many people are going, but also how many deaths there have been so far this year. What was going through your mind when you were planning and summiting Everest? in terms of what that could mean for you.
When I seen the crowds, I initially wanted to get ahead of everybody just to stay, you know, just for safety for one, and number two, I just better to climb without big groups. So once I was ahead of everybody and up to the balcony, I really slowed down my pace, probably like at least half the pace that I was climbing at beforehand. And I just took my time to get to the summit. I had a full frame Sony camera with me, and I actually didn't take any photos. You know, like if you lose a glove, you lose a hand. So I didn't want to make any mistakes until I got to the summit. So I didn't really take many photos at all along the climbing route, up or down. And I didn't really pull my camera out until I got to the summit. And then, like I say, as soon as it was time to leave Camp 4, I went all the way back down to base camp just, you know, to get out of the altitude. You know, there's a lot of stories of people dying in their tents and stuff like that, and I just didn't want to be one of those people. So as soon as I got off of oxygen and I just kept descending and getting down off the mountain was my number one priority. Get up and get down.
Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of people don't plan or train to go to Everest. A lot of what they hear about Everest is the summits and the depths. It's very black and white. Did you kind of think that that was a possibility for you that you could die up there?
That never really actually entered my mind much at all. I was more concentrating just on climbing and doing what, like, everything that was in front of me at that time. You know, I wasn't really thinking too much ahead about too much. I just was concentrating on breathing and climbing. I wasn't really looking at where I was too far ahead. I was just making, you know, small plans, you know, get to this point, get to that point. Like, my first goal was to get to the balcony. So I got to the balcony, and then, you know, I was ahead of all the groups, and then I slowed down, and I just wanted to get to the top of the south summit, and then so I got to the top of the south summit. And then from there, you can see the actual summit, and you can see the corner traverse, and then I was like, okay. And then I seen the Hillary Step, and I was like, okay, I'm going to make it to the Hillary Step. So just, like, short goals is basically how I climbed in.
Is there anything about the experience of actually climbing or summiting Everest that you would like to share?
Well, I think for me, the whole trip was, like, fantastic. Like, our group, there was no injuries. There was no delays, really. There was, you know, like, the trip went really, really well. And so when you see all the media attention afterwards for two poorly planned days, and I think, you know, there's a lot of people calling for Nepal to limit permits and to limit stuff that's going on there. But at the end of the day, Nepal just issues the permits, and they don't really have a say in when people climb. So it's not really Nepal's fault that there's huge lineups on certain days. It's up to the operators and the guided companies to communicate to one another and say, hey, we're going on this day or we're going on that day, and try and minimize the crowds. You know, a lot of what happened there was their own doing. The way I look at it, I was permit leader, so I had to go meet the Minister of Tourism before my permit was issued, and then a debrief afterwards. They're super appreciative of us, of people going to their country and climbing or hiking or doing whatever, because tourism is a huge, that's like their number one source of revenue for the country, right? So for them to limit permit is limiting how much money actually goes into their coffers. So I can't really see them doing that. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't really have to do that because people on the mountain aren't coordinating the climbing properly. You know what I mean? So I think Nepal itself is kind of getting a bad rap for something that they can't really control. Shouldn't have to really control.
So we briefly touched about what it was like on the summit for you, that you were there for about an hour and that there was a saxophone for a bit of it. but can you describe what it felt like to be on the summit? I think a lot of people imagine that moment for themselves. What was it actually like for you?
So that being on the actual summit, just concentrating on, like, not losing my gloves and, you know, getting my stuff out, getting pictures, setting up my camera. So all that stuff went fairly quickly, it seemed like. Even though I was up there for like an hour, it all seemed like it happened very fast. And so when you're doing all that, you're not really enjoying the moment. I think for me, though, the one of the coolest things that happened on the whole ascent was when I, like, actually where the viral picture is, people going across the corner traverse just below Hillary Step where that huge lineup is. Well, when I was there, there was nobody. And that's actually when the sun rose for me. So when the sun came up, like, it comes up on the right side, on the Tibet side, and that whole side of the corner traverse, because it's snow, we all just lit up pink. So the whole right side, that whole ridge line, the right-hand side of it was all bright pink, and then the other side was a shadow. And so I could literally take my right hand and dip it into Tibet, and it was like dipping into the sunrise. It was
It was surreal. It was spectacular. It was one of the most stunning things I've ever seen in the mountains. I've summited, I've climbed and skied, probably 100 mountains, and I've never had a summit day where I've been able to do that. And then you look to the left, and there's the classic shadow of Everest, the pyramid that just cascades for like 100 miles away, you know what I mean? Like, the sunrise was unbelievable.
And I imagine that's a moment you didn't actually photograph, but one
I didn't,
stick
I didn't
with
photograph.
You.
If I was going to pull my camera out, that definitely would have been the time, but I didn't. I was just looking at the Hillary step, and I just wanted to get there and get up and get down.
Mm-hmm. Since you've been back in Squamish only for a few days, you've already been climbing again. You've already been back on the Chief. Tell me about what motivates you to keep climbing after such a huge endeavor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was actually thinking about rock climbing quite a bit. Like, it looks like Squamish had a pretty good stretch of decent weather, and a lot of my friends were rock climbing, and I was getting lots of, even though I was posting stuff being on Everest, I was actually kind of jealous of all the good climbing that was going on in Squamish while I was gone. So as soon as I got home, I really wanted to get out. But the first couple of days, I was tired. And then yesterday, I figured I'd give it a shot, and I was pretty slow, but I had a lot of fun. It was great to be back out on the rock.
How did it feel to be back on rock at sea level? You didn't have to wear nearly as much gear.
Well, I didn't get full on frostbite, but I got cold feet. So like my big toes right now, I kind of have a slight bit of numbness in them that'll go away. So climbing slab and being on the rock was a little bit hard on my big toes, but it went pretty good. It went better than I thought it was going to, actually. Still a lot of fun. It was great. I did DG and the Rambles, 8 pitches or something. That was enough.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now that all is said and done, what's next for you?
What's next? So actually being in Everest Base Camp, you meet a lot of people, and I got a lot of opportunities for next spring. I just got to see if I can get some more time off work. There's a Canadian expedition to Kanchenjunga, which is the third tallest mountain in the world. So it's another 8,000er. It's in like the far east of Nepal. It's not a very well-known mountain. A bunch of my teammates from Everest this year, they want to go to Makalu next spring.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an opportunity there. And then I still want to get down to Antarctica and ski Mount Vincent. So that's kind of a big goal for me too. I got some time here. I'll think about it and maybe make a decision here in the next month or so with what to aim for next year. But there's definitely some mountains to climb for next year for sure.
Great. Well, it sounds like you're not running out of anything to do. All right. Well, thanks so much for being available. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Sounds great.
The Squamish Sound is brought to you by the Squamish Chief. The music for this episode was produced by Stephen Chua, cover photo by Clayton Matthews. Have a story tip? Give us a call at 604-892-9161. Send an email to news@squamishchief.com. You can read these stories and more online at squamishchief.com, the newspaper, and have the news delivered to your door every week.